Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Eddie. Thank you, Evelyn, and thanks for everybody for making this. This is unbelievable, standing up here and seeing this many alcoholics in one place. I appreciate having a chance to come do some service today, remember who I am. And, you know, I'm a real alcoholic. There are pitchers of water up here, but I have my own little secret stash I'm keeping right here for myself. And I'm going to try to keep this very short because I think we're going to a round robin after this, and I want to make sure everyone has the opportunity to share. We're going to be starting with this gentleman over here and going to the left. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I can't safely and successfully drink alcohol, which is why I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's unlikely I'd be standing in a hotel sharing my story, but this is what I do, I guess, a day at a time when AA says, "You want to do some service?" Yeah, I do. It's not an exaggeration for me to say that Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, and the program saved my life. I don't think that that's hyperbole or anything. I mean, I honestly, I owe my life to this fellowship. And, you know, when they say do service, you say yeah. In hindsight, looking back, it's easy to see, you know, the way anything makes sense. You look back and go, oh, yeah. I had symptoms of alcoholism, I think, before I even really started drinking, hardcore drinking, alcoholic drinking. When I was a kid, I used to like to draw pictures, and I imagined that I was going to be an artist. I was going to be a cartoonist. While other people were developing their skill through discipline and the practice of drawing, developing their style and their voice, I was developing my signature, learning how to sign my name like a cartoonist, so it looked really cool and badass, and people would go, hey, that's a, you know, and that's the way that I want to write my name. And this exercise in self-centeredness is very kind of alcoholic. I had that kind of personality where I wasn't going to be one of those people that did all the work involved with doing something and then talking about it later. I was going to be the guy that talked a lot about it and didn't really do it once it started getting difficult or once it required any kind of discipline or consistency or perseverance or focus. That just wasn't, you know, going to happen for me. And these things would just be, I think, personality issues that you could work on later, if not for the fact that I also developed an allergy to alcohol.
This guy's got a soft voice.
And it's important to acknowledge that the thing that separates me from someone who's not an alcoholic is I can't safely drink alcohol because I have a physical allergy or an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Once I start drinking, I find it incredibly difficult to stop or moderate once I get started. And the symptoms of this occurred pretty early on as well. As soon as I was able to bankroll myself or generate the revenue that was needed to acquire the amount of alcohol that I needed to get right, and that amount increased as it goes forward, alcoholism being a progressive illness. But in the beginning, you know, I was funding myself and trying to keep myself in enough alcohol to get comfortable. I had a job as a busboy out on Long Island. And I used to get off work and stand on the elevated platform waiting for the Long Island Railroad after I got off a shift of working, and there was a little dinky bar downstairs, like the little Railroad Inn. And I wouldn't even like to call it a dive bar. It would be make it sound more interesting than what it really was. It was just like a blank bar. And late at night, there was no one in there. It had like red walls and some old dude who was just a bartender and the TV with static on. I don't even remember anything about it. But I remember I used to run down there because they would serve me, and I would have a glass of beer. And I would miss the train. And it's not a train that I wanted to miss. When you're standing on the platform waiting for the Long Island Road, it's freezing. I want to go home. I'm tired. And I'm not really enjoying myself. But I had a sense of safety sitting at that bar. And I could not remove myself. So, I'm barreling up the concrete steps to get a train that I'm going to miss. Now, you know, we have experiences. You know, I miss the train. I missed my appointment because of self-inflicted stupidness. But this became a way of life for me. This whole, like, I forgot what time, I don't know. I'm always running, you know. And later on when I was in college, I'd run out of money, and I drank all my money. And they didn't have ATM, believe it or not, they didn't have ATM machines on every corner, which is so weird to say that now. But I'm in college, they didn't have an ATM. So I used to go across the street to the grocery store and write a check for the amount plus 20. Or the amount plus 40. I tried to write one time. And the lady's like, hey, what do you think? This is not a bank. You can't come in here. But I need that money. You know what I'm saying? And by the way, other people in the grocery store buying food and taking it home and cooking food for themselves. Which right away, I started to experience that diverging from what other people do. I'm sitting in a bar looking out the window like it's a fish tank watching the people have lives and operate like normal human beings. And I was so hammered drunk one night in college. It was a Friday night, I remember, because I'm in my dormitory, and I want to listen to this Friday night radio program, the Friday Night Master Mix, with DJ Red Alert was on Friday night, so anybody who remembers that. And I got a boombox, and I'm trying to tune the station. I'm so blind drunk that I can't find the station. I have my hand over one eye, and I'm trying to find, and I want to find this station. And this is alcohol interfering. You know, I drank more. Here's the criteria for an alcoholic for me is like I drank more than I wanted to. And not just once. So this is like a way of life for me. I finally get the station, and I go into the kitchen, and I open the refrigerator, and I pulled out a quart of Ballantine. And I held it in my hand, and I looked at it, and I remember thinking to myself, I am hammer drunk right now. I do not need this. I don't want to open this, because if I open it, I know I'm going to drink the whole thing, right? And I saw my hand opening this bottle, and I saw my hand putting it up to my face and thinking, this has got to stop. I don't really want to do this. So this is a symptom of the physical allergy to alcohol. It makes it impossible for me to stop. And later, I mean, towards the end, I mean, I buy a movie ticket, and I can't make the movie. Because I can't stop drinking. A movie that I want to see. So if I can't make a movie or I can't listen to the radio because of my drinking, what are the odds I'm going to go see a dentist? Or, right? What are the odds that I'm going to go to see an accountant? What are the odds that I'm going to go to my grandfather's funeral? What are the odds that I'm going to do things that are uncomfortable? But these things that are uncomfortable are the bedrock of adult life that I'm now disqualified from because I can't stop drinking. But I could see it. I started to become aware that this is going to end badly, right? Because on top of this comes the war stories, the terribleness, the horrible stories of drinking, the alcoholic lifestyle. So this has got to stop. So I did what a sane, normal person does. I decide I'm going to stop drinking, and I quit drinking. And I quit drinking a whole bunch of times throughout my story. But the last time, or one of the last times that I tried to quit drinking by myself, I came up against what I understand today, I think, is the most dangerous part of the illness, alcoholism, and that is the mental part. The mental component of Alcoholics Anonymous, the mental part of the disease, it's a threefold disease, right? It's mental, it's physical, and spiritual. The mental part is so dangerous because, and I don't know this until I get here, obviously, but it's like I have a blind spot that makes it impossible for me to remember that I can't safely and successfully drink, even though I swear to God and everybody else that I'm not going to drink anymore. I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. Every time I picked up the first drink again, I was cold sober. So my thinking process is corrupted by alcoholism even when I'm not drinking. The calls are coming from inside the house. All right? You know what I'm saying? And, you know, like, this is with strong sponsorship and meetings every day and with a practice of the steps, we get that. Like, my sponsor, like, you cannot fix your sick mind with your own sick mind. You can't reformat the hard drive with the computer itself. You know what I mean? So you need to have that. But I didn't know this. I'm missing two things. A fellowship of people that aren't drinking and a program of action to recover from this thing that is going to kill me. I mean, at the end, I'm bouncing around. I'm summarily bounced out of every place of residence. I got thrown out of college. I got thrown out of my dad's house. I got thrown out of here. I'm bouncing around, and for some reason, I don't have any idea why. I was thinking about this guy. He's a friend of my mom's when we were little kids. And he had an apartment in Queens, and he said, you need someplace to stay for the summer, come stay in my apartment, I'm going to be out of town. Oh, great. So I got July, August, whatever it was, June, July, and August, the whole summer, I could stay in this guy's place, and he goes, all you got to do is just buy me an air conditioner and install it in the window, and that's all I want you to do for me, and you can stay here rent-free. And it sounds like a grab. I go, absolutely, why would I not do that? And I had every intention of buying this guy an air conditioner. But it wasn't like, oh, you know, screw that guy. It was like, dude, I really appreciated this guy doing this for me. But I had a sense, even when I first got there, that buying and installing an air conditioner is outside of my ability as a human being at this point. Because every single dime that I have is going towards drinking. And whatever's left over, I'm eating chicken gizzards from the Chinese place. A quart of chicken gizzards. A quart of Yung Chow fried rice. Because it's a dollar, and that's my food budget. And everything else, I need to get as much alcohol as I get my hands on. So I stayed on a bender for the whole summer. I drank through the whole summer months. And when I wasn't face down on this guy's floor or hammered drunk, I read everything I could get my hands on in this guy's apartment. And he had books about meditation. He had books about self-actualization and self-help and you know, I read the Bible, the whole thing. I tried to get my hands on anything I could get my hands on to try, because I knew there was something horribly wrong going on with me, and it was no help whatsoever. So I bottomed out, and I wound up waking up on either end of the F train. I'm falling out on the either end of the Lexington Avenue line, and you know, I'm falling out on the subway platforms. It's not happy times. So I'm crashing and burning. It's in the early 90s, and I had a freelance job. Somehow, by miracle, I fell into this freelance job. And I had a coworker, a production manager, that was a recovering alcoholic. And I had become into work going, I got to quit drinking. And she said, I quit drinking. And I was like, really? And there was a whole bunch of people that worked in this. It was in Midtown, and they're going, what'd you do this weekend? You have plans this weekend? You doing anything fun this weekend? And what'd you do this weekend? Did you have a good weekend? And I'm like, you know, I was drinking and smoking crack all weekend. And these people are going to Martha's Vineyards, and they're going sailing, or they're picking strawberries, or whatever people are doing on the weekends. And I'm like, but this one lady I knew, she looked at me, and she knew. And it was like, I almost fell off the fire escape this weekend, you know? And I almost, like, I almost fell between the cars of a subway train this weekend. And she wasn't horrified by that, and she didn't think it was as funny as I did, but she also kind of knew what I was talking about. So when I said I got to quit drinking, because I was waking up with the kind of hangovers, by the way, I should mention as well. If I woke up today feeling the way I felt every single day, I would go directly to the hospital. All right. I mean, I had the shakes. I was a blackout drinker. So she recognized and she said, I quit drinking. The easiest thing I ever did was quit drinking. And then she said, the hardest thing I ever did was stay sober. And there's a part in Bill's discussion of step one in the 12 and 12 where he says, when one alcoholic puts in the mind of another alcoholic the real nature of his problem, that person will not be the same again. And I was not the same after that. And I drank almost immediately after that. But I remember the seed was planted. And then things got really much badly worse. I moved into a neighborhood where the air conditioner guy was, by the way. I'm going, I'm never going to see that guy again. Now I'm living in his neighborhood crashing on with this bartender guy. He gives me a room in the back. I'm renting for $300 a month. I can't make the rent. I got the landlord's daughter is knocking on the door. She comes in and she's seeing a horror show. I still see the look on this young woman's face. It's like, I was living like a freaking savage, and she walked in to try to ask me for my rent, and I wanted to kill myself every day. So I wind up, somehow I'm in an office of a psychotherapist describing the symptoms of alcoholic depression, and I'm telling her, you know, give me what you got, you know, because I feel like I'm going to kill myself. And she says, do you drink and use drugs? And I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? But I started to tell the truth a little bit, and then I'm going, you know, my mother, my father, whatever my problems are, and she says, for us to try to deal with your problems that you think you have, while you're still drinking, it's like trying to put your pants on over your head. It's not going to happen. So she sends me to a meeting, and I still didn't go, and I still went out and got drunk, and I finally walk into the Mustard Seed Group in March of 92. I started counting days, and that's the last time I had a drink. That's the beginning of my... thank you. It's you guys. I mean, that's the end of my story. I don't have anything, I got nothing after that. Now it becomes AA's story, and it's a story about a home group and strong sponsorship and a practice of the 12 steps. A couple of things I just mentioned briefly. I was fortunate I came into a group where there were people that gave me good basic training in AA. And when I'm talking about, I know I can't drink, I just know I can't drink, there's a guy, Kurt, this guy who's like a phantom. I don't know what happened to him. It's like he showed up and he became like this guy to me who would say things like, oh, I could drink. I was like, you're not supposed to say that. He's like, I could drink right now. This is not about you're not allowed to drink and you can't drink. I'm here because I can drink. And he's like, oh, shit. And so the idea is that my recovery, my sobriety cannot be taken away from me and I can't lose it, but I could throw it away just like that. And that was impressed on me by this guy. The other thing I said is I got the IRS coming after me. I got problems with my family. I got problems with my employment. I got depression problems. I got therapy issues. I got family problems. I got problems with men. I got problems with women. I got problems with abandonment. I got problems with rejection. I have all problems with the medication that I'm on. I got side effects. And Kurt would say to me, listen, we're not doctors. We're not relationship counselors. We're not job counselors. We're not therapists. But it sounds like you got a lot of problems. If I was you, I wouldn't drink. So that's the kind of training that I got early on. And like they say, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous sustained me long enough until I could start to get my teeth into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which changes us like that. adjustment that we get from a practice of the 12 steps. And, you know, I had to cross that bridge. I had to cross the bridge into step 4 and 5. The house cleaning process, the scrubbing in 4 and 5, hitting the street in steps 8 and 9, I had to track that guy down and go, I'm here about your air conditioner. And by then, he had already had an air conditioner, but he had, like, a giant manuscript that he needed to have typeset, and I was able to help him with that. And every opportunity that I had, in some cases, completely inadequate and feeble attempts to make things right, the act of saying, I'm here about the harm that I've done, started to change me on the inside and give me that foundation that we could stand on, the self-respect. You start to stand upright. And I'll just want to close, I guess. You know, it was obviously, I kind of really feel like I want to talk about this the last couple of minutes. Three, 4 years ago, I went back to art school. I went back to the Art Students League drawing class with my friend at the time, Linda, who encouraged me and both of us to show up on Thursday to do drawing. Even though we were both pretty established artists, it was like, we're going to learn how to draw again. And I found out I'm still gripping the pencil way too tight. You need to relax. You need to let go a little bit. And it was a process, and we encouraged each other. And I learned how to draw again. I started to become more consistent about drawing. And in the process, Linda and I, we fell in love with each other, and we got closer together to each other. And last Saturday, a week ago yesterday, we got married. This is an unlikely and unbelievable occurrence for me, because it wasn't within the realm of what was going to happen. I was one of those disgustingly and dangerously antisocial people from drinking, and I had the type of lifestyle that there was no room for this. And suddenly, like, you know, Bill's discussion of step 12, he says, if we're ever going to be emotionally secure among grown-up people, we have to start to put our lives on a give-and-take basis. Now, this is a challenge. This is why it's step 12, and this is, God willing, I'll be the rest of my life sober, is learning how to do that. And we're doing it at home. We're learning how to do that. I'm learning how to do that at work and taking it out onto the street to be a citizen of New York City, be citizens of the world. We are free now, you know, to move around because we're clean and sober. I'm abstinent a day at a time. Thank God. I'm grateful I didn't have to take a drink today, and I appreciate my sobriety. That's I guess, all for me. Thanks a lot for letting me share.
My name is Joanne, and I'm an alcoholic. And it is a real privilege to be here today on AA's 77th birthday. And, you know, I've been coming to this meeting for many years, but let me just tell you, from up here, this really is a big meeting. I appreciated Ed sharing, and I identified with a lot of things that he said, and that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. For the most part, anybody who gets up there and identifies as themselves as an alcoholic, I understand what they're coming from, and I understand them, and I know that they understand me, and that's the common bond of AA. And I'm just, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing that has ever happened to me in my life. It completely changed my life. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I'm a product of the late 50s, early 60s kind of environment, you know, Irish Catholic, you don't tell anybody what you had for breakfast, you know, everything gets shoved under the rug, and, you know, I remember as a little girl, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, you know, my father would take us to Mass. And he would make sure that we got out of Mass by 12 o'clock, because that's when the bars opened. And he would take me and my brother, or maybe my other brother as well, into these, you know, dark, smelly Irish bars that I absolutely loved. You know, these men would buy us cherry cokes. They taught us how to shoot pool. We played the jukebox. It was unbelievable. I absolutely loved it, you know. But, of course, my father made me swear that I wouldn't tell anybody where I was, you know. So I learned early, you know, don't tell anybody what you had for breakfast. And also from this kind of line of thinking, as a kid, my mother had just had a baby, and my aunt was taking my brothers and I to Mass. And you know, even though my childhood was fine, you know, my thinking was a little different. What I absorbed as a kid was different. And we were running a little late for Mass on Easter Sunday. And my aunt was marching us up the aisle, and the organ was playing. And I started singing, "My Beer is Rheingold, the Dry Beer." So, you know, this is... You know, this is how it began. So it was really, you know, I was kind of an accident waiting to happen. I started drinking young. I didn't drink for that long. And I came to AA young. I had trouble with alcohol right from the beginning, from the time that I picked up my first drink till the time that I put it down. Many of the things that happened to me over the course of the 10 years that I drank, I thought were perfectly normal. I thought everybody who drank didn't remember what they did. And I didn't know about blackouts till I came to AA. When I first started drinking, alcohol gave me what I didn't have inside. You know, it allowed me to be the person I wanted to be. You know, I was a shy kid. I was a shy teenager. Alcohol gave me all the things I was looking for, you know. And it gave me a lot of other things, too. You know, I started to equate drinking with, you know, things that I could do, powers that I would attain, you know. I mean, you become very powerful when you drink, you know. And when I started high school, I joined the swimming team. And even at 13, 14, 15, I'm 5'9". I was 5'9 then, so I was encouraged to join the swimming team. And one of the girls on the team used to practice on Friday night, brought a half a pint of Seagram 7. And she said to me, "You know, have a few sips of this, you know, you'll do better." So, you know, what she didn't realize was, you know, she shouldn't have passed me the bottle for a few sips because I probably drank half of it. But the point being is that I went out, swam, and won a medal. So in my mind, you know, drinking helped me to be a better swimmer. And that was my attitude towards a lot of things with alcohol. You know, it made me better, it made me bigger, it made me funny, it made me a lot of things. What I didn't know at the time as I continued to drink was that I'm alcoholic and I drink differently than other people. I can't drink safely, I can't take one drink. When I take the first drink, I have no control over how much or when I stop or anything else or what I drink or anything else. And that's what makes me different. And I didn't know that at the time. And, you know, the most horrific words to me as a teenager drinking in the bars of Bay Ridge was last call, you know. That was like the worst thing you could possibly say. I'd say, "I'll have six," you know. And they'd say, "Well, we can't give you six. All right, give me four." You know, my friends didn't do that. I did that. You know, but that's kind of the way that I grew up and how my relationship with alcohol evolved. The thing of it was, as I kept drinking, my relationship with alcohol and in life in general started to change. And my drinking started to change. I started to drink more. I started to drink more often. And what was happening to me, which I didn't know until I came to AA, was alcohol was starting to make my life choices for me. And I didn't know about that until I came here. It kept me from doing things that I wanted to do, and it made me do things that I didn't want to do. It was that simple, you know. I went to college because I really didn't want to work. You know, I wanted like another 4-year lull so I could, you know, drink and hang out, which is basically what I did. And, you know, I drank my way through 4 years of college, and I was drinking every day by the time I graduated. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I took all kinds of tests. I took civil service tests. I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a million things. I took the first female police test. I took an air traffic controller's test. I took all kinds of things. I got called for American Airlines, and, you know, I never showed up for any of these things. This was probably a good thing, except if I had gone to the cops, I'd long be retired, which would be the only good thing. But in any event, when I got out, I needed to get a job because I needed money to drink. And I took the first job that was offered to me, which was someone's assistant typing 8 words a minute, and I got the job as a secretary. You know, so I I go along there and I find people like me and I start drinking at lunchtime and I start having a fine time. But the difference between myself and the people that I work with is that, you know, they'd have a couple of drinks, have lunch and go back to work, which I did for a period of time too. Then I just had a few extra drinks and skipped the lunch, and then afterwards I'd say, well, I'll see you later, you know. And, you know, I wouldn't go back. So I started to have problems, is the point of all of this. I was having a lot of problems in general. I was having family problems. I was having employer problems. I was having emotional problems. And I was starting to feel, you know, very much more withdrawn and into myself, and this is a direct result of alcoholism. At some point, a year or so before I came to AA, I remember going to, my father had left me a bunch of pamphlets, and you know, I was highly insulted, stuck them in my pocketbook because I really did want to read them, but I didn't want him to know that I was reading them. And I went to work one day, and I went to a bar that I didn't usually go to, and I pulled the pamphlets out on the bar. And the bartender at the time had worked in a place that I did frequent pretty often, and I said, oh, you know, what are you doing here? He said, filling in, and I have these pamphlets all spread out of the bar. And I said to him, listen, do you think I have a drinking problem? And he said, yes. So I picked up my pamphlets and left because I was highly insulted. Anyway, somewhere during this period I had a boyfriend, and he didn't, you know, I was hiding my drinking, and he said, you know, we're going to drive cross country and you're going to stop drinking. And we were going to be gone for 3 weeks or a month or something like that. And this was, you know, a number of years ago, long before the internet. I remember going up to the public library and looking in the encyclopedia because I heard about dry states and I didn't want to wind up in any. So, anyway, I get all this information and time comes to pack and I have an enormous suitcase that I borrowed from my aunt and I wrapped wine bottles very lovingly in towels and that was coming with me and my clothes were in a knapsack. So, you know, we take off on this trip. To say it was horrific is an understatement. You know, I hadn't been out of Brooklyn, and I'm going to all these fabulous places. You know, I'm going to the Grand Canyon. I'm going to Bryce. I'm going to all these wonderful places. And my biggest concern was, how am I going to get that bottle out, and what am I going to do with the empty one? You know? So, anyway, when I came back, I said, you know, this will never happen to me again, absolutely never. So he was jettisoned, of course. And, you know, I kept drinking for another couple of more years. I went to a meeting on a Friday night. I called up Intergroup drunk before I left work. I was really drunk, and I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself, and I said, let me call Intergroup. I didn't even have any idea what Intergroup was. So I called them up. I get a very nice person on the phone who tells me, you know, maybe I should go to a meeting, and maybe that would help me stop drinking. You know, I'm like boo-hooing, my life is falling apart, no one understands me, and all the usual laundry list of things. And I keep drinking. I have a couple of drinks, you know, to fortify myself before I go to this AA meeting. And I get into a taxi, which of course I can't pay for because I have no money. I spent my last few dollars on a six-pack to take to the meeting when I went. So I get to the meeting, I'm fighting with the cab driver, I have the six-pack in my pocketbook, you know, he takes off and I, you know, stroll into the meeting. And I sit in the back and I take out the six-pack and I take out a can and, you know, pop the top. And about 60 heads turned around. There was a woman who belonged to that group that I came to know very well in later years as a member of that group myself, by the name of Teddy, and she came back to me and she said, dear, what are you doing? And I said, well, this is AA. She said, we don't do that here. So in any event, that was my actual first sit in a meeting. I drank for another small period of time, but everything was really at the end. And I went into a detox, and I came out, and I decided to, I was going to try AA. I was 24 years old, and I really felt that life was over. I thought I was being banished to AA. That's how I felt. It was as good as Siberia as far as I was concerned. And I walked into the Bay Ridge group, and everybody was at least 80 except me. And there used to be a row of women that they used to call the matinee ladies because they all wore navy blue and pearls. And one of the men from the group brought me over and introduced me to a woman by the name of Mary, who was going to become my sponsor. And this woman really saved my life. She absolutely did. And the journey for me began on that day. And, you know, to say it wasn't easy, it wasn't easy. I would not want to have to go through my first year in AA ever again, but I know now that if I continue to come to meetings and do the things that I learned as a beginner, I will not have to repeat that. I know I have another drunk. I don't know if there's another recovery. This may be the only chance I get to come to AA. And, you know, over the course of the next 35 years, life changed dramatically. It changed drastically. And all of the things that I wanted, the small little things that I wanted from life began to happen. You know, I just wanted to be like everybody else. I just didn't want to feel the way that I was feeling. I didn't want to think the way that I was thinking. You know, I wanted the white picket fence and the golden retriever and all of that stuff. And none of that was happening because of alcohol. And, you know, AA has given me the opportunity, you know, to change my life and to live my life the best way that I see fit. Has it been problem-free? Of course not. Absolutely not. You know, life happens and life continues to happen. But the difference now is that the longer that I stay in AA, the more tools I have, the more weapons I have in the arsenal, you know, and there's no reason for me to pick up a drink, you know. I can do a lot of things. Drinking is not one of them, you know, and I know that now. You know, I know that as true as I know my own name. And as a result of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I've been able to live my life and to do the things that I wanted to do, you know. I mean, I have done things that I remember the first sober vacation I took. I went to California, and I had, you know, to me this was my first vacation, and, you know, I had packed 3 suitcases because I had 4 different weather, you know, clothes for 4 different types of weather. You know, I didn't know what it was going to be, but, you know, I have to carry this, you know. You know, I know differently now, you know, but, and I've been able to do so many of these things. You know, the things that I learned when I was new, the things that I learned from my sponsor, the things that I learned from other members in my group are exactly the same things that have carried me through. You know, I don't drink a day at a time. I go to meetings and I help somebody else. Thank you.
Hello and good afternoon, everyone. My name is John and I'm an alcoholic. Very happy to be here today at the 77th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fantastic, simple program, and I hope that it always stays as simple as it, you know, that it is and was when it started. So, you know, this is a fantastic, you know, event, and just, you know, thinking back, you know, to when I first came in here, I can remember, you know, coming into my first meeting and just, you know, looking around and not really sure if I was, you know, going to be welcome. Because if you're anything like me, when I came in here, I really wasn't welcome in a lot of places. I was kind of like said, you know, there's a door over there, just go that way or go that way. Or just kind of like, you know. And I looked up and I saw that, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I knew, to me, that meant that you guys couldn't throw me out. And, you know, that meant a lot to me because, like I said, I had been asked to leave a lot of places. And, you know, I want to thank, you know, everybody, anybody who has had anything to do with putting this event together. You know, I'm not really sure, you know, also in looking around this room today, too, I can remember at that very first meeting I kind of had, I was taking all of your inventories, looking around, and I was like, you know, what do these people have in common? You know, like, is this some kind of like, you know, sales conference? Is this some kind of pyramid scheme? I didn't really get it, you know. And then I was trying to like, you know, I was going through like a census in my head to check the box, the income, the race, the gender, and nothing made sense, you know. And you'd have to really scroll really far down the list until you got to the checkbox, which we'd all identify with was, you know, somewhere way down there is like, I wish to control my drinking. We check that box, you know. My case is different. We check that box, you know. You know, but those are really, really far down on the list. And, you know, I felt different. You know, I grew up in Minnesota, and, you know, I don't know what it was, but, you know, I always felt that someday there's going to be some, you know, government-looking car which is going to pull up at the front door of this black sedan, and, you know, there's going to be a knock at the door, and they're going to say, like, you know what? There's going to be all these guys dressed in dark 60s suits with really thin ties, and they're going to walk up to me with sunglasses, and they're going to say, you know what? This went way too far. We've been watching you for years, and we let this get out of control, and we're sorry what has happened to you. Come with us, and we're going to take you. And like, you know, I was waiting for that. You know, because that's how I felt. You know, I was adopted, and I thought that made me different, and I have parents of a different racial background. I grew up without a father, and I grew up of a family with very limited means, and you know, all that stuff was out there, and I've been going to counseling, and I even had to go to an inpatient mental health facility for a while, and you know, while I was, you know, and they really couldn't find anything wrong with me, so I was sitting in there, you know, I was there for like a week, and I can remember that week was actually the week of the local county fair, and so I ran away. You know, and I ran away and I went to the county fair. Then I went back home and they came and found me and they're like, well, there's really nothing wrong with you. And, you know, when I think about it, I wasn't able to describe it at the time, but, you know, and I couldn't describe it to any of my counselors at the time. I just had this, like, pressure. And it was just, like, just blowing up. Like, I felt like my head was just exploding. I was just looking for some kind of sense of relief. And, you know, and I can remember one day, you know, I was probably about 15 or so, and, I got together with a friend of mine, and we found this guy who was a senior in the high school. He's a little bit bigger guy, and you know that's the guy you get to buy, you know. So we walked up to him and got together like our $50 or $53, and goes, you know, here's this and here's our list of stuff. I want a liter of Bacardi because you know I somehow I knew my stuff at the time. I want a liter of Bacardi and these two types of schnapps and some vodka, and you know the guy went away, and he was supposed to meet us at the town square. I grew up in a small town outside Minneapolis, and he was supposed to meet us at the town square, and he came back with, you know, pints, you know. So immediately I had a resentment, like, I know I was supposed to get a bigger bottle, I'm getting a smaller bottle, and I didn't really know what to do. And you know, we took those, and I downed a pint of the Bacardi, and I downed another pint of that root beer schnapps, and as I was drinking that, all of a sudden just that pressure release, you know, and I can still remember how that felt today. Just finally, you know, and I didn't consciously do it, but immediately at that moment, in that time, you know, they talk about the phenomenon of craving, all that stuff. I didn't know I was experiencing that. I just knew that I had that pressure release to life, which I had always been looking for, you know, and immediately I just said, this is my answer for whatever happens. I made that decision subconsciously or consciously, whatever, at that exact moment. And I can remember, you know, I said, you know, let's go to the mall, you know, because that was the spot to go, and tuck off to the mall. And I don't know if I drank a little bit more. And I woke up the next morning, and I was back at the same place that was the mental hospital, but I was on the other side. They called it the West Wing. I was on the other side of the hospital, so I recognized the bed sheets. And I was laying in the bed sheets, and it was like a little twin bed, and the bed sagged down, if you will. And I was laying there, and I looked, and there's my clothes on the floor. I was wearing like a little hospital gown. There's some woman sitting next to me, and she's like, you're in the hospital. You know, we had to watch you last night, and you know, my blood alcohol was over 0.3 something. And they're like, you know, we didn't know if you were going to make it. And I just remember sitting in that pool of the vomit, and she's like, you know, you've got a problem with drinking. You can't drink. I'm like, you kidding me? That was the first time I drank last night. And, you know, that's my very first night. And she's like, no. No one drinks like that for their first time. And, you know, she doesn't know me, okay? And You know, but, you know, laying there in that pool of vomit, and, you know, and I'd been changed a few times, and, you know, it didn't matter, because it wasn't what alcohol did to me, it was what alcohol did for me, and that was the difference. And that's what all those counselors never really, you know, understood. It's not to their fault. You know, they just didn't understand that when I drink, I'm doing it because I feel. This is what it does for me. In spite of laying in a bed, a pool of vomit, that if that is a very small price to pay for that, that pressure release feeling that I got, you know. And I went on drinking for a while, and you know, as the drinking goes on, the consequences go up, and you know, the sense of satisfaction is going down, and you can take that curve way over to the end of the room, you know. But I always kept going because I just thought that, you know what, it gives me some relief, even if that relief is very, very diminishing at best, and maybe sometime, some way, this next drink, whether I drink this, that, or something else, somehow it's going to make me feel like I did the first time, and it's going to be different. And somehow this is going to work for me. And I went on drinking like that for, you know, a while. And eventually I got to the point, you know, I'd done a number of the, you know, external factors, and I kept trying to, like, change things on the outside because, you know, I thought that my problem was on the outside. I had more counseling sessions and more people again and again and again. You got to stop drinking. It's the alcohol. It's the alcohol. I had some minor, affiliations with law enforcement from time to time, I'd call it that. You know, nothing too severe, just a little bit of stuff here and there. And, you know, and eventually I figured, you know what, it's this darn climate and it's this Swedish Lutherans that I'm living with. And I was, you know, this church I go to, and it's this family, although my family is very loving and supportive and never really, you know, they completely accepted me. And, you know, it was just them. It was them out there. So I did what any sensible person would do. I went to the library and looked at the encyclopedia, and I was flipping through the pages, and I remember coming across the St. Thomas, and there's like a little caption in St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and it said, "The island where the angels go to rest." And I was like, you know what? I'm an angel, and I need to rest. I've had a hard life. I need to stop and just rest. That's what it's all about. Plus, it's warm, and I'm not going through another Minnesota winter. And so, you know, I managed to get together some about $150 and got a bus ticket from Minneapolis to Chicago, and I spent like $12 on donuts at the bus station, and now I'm down like $140. I got myself a one-way ticket down to the Virgin Islands. And I can remember the plane circling around the, you know, Charlotte Amalie, and I was like, the pilot's saying, you know, there's a lot of UV down here, and the thought came to me, wow, this is real, and this is actually happening. And I have to go through with it, okay? I have to chase this insanity to its natural end, okay? I can't back down now. You know, when the plane landed and I walked out of there, and there's mostly tourists, right? Because it's a tourist destination, mostly tourists, and they're taking, you know, people where to go, and I think I had a little bit of money left, and I got in the taxi, and I can remember just the taxi driver, okay, where do you want to go? And, you know, when you realize for just a hair bit of time that you have no idea where you're going, and that you're running away from yourself, where do you go to run away from yourself? There isn't a destination that you can do that. And I even remember her giving me the suggestion, like, maybe I should take you to the town. I'm like, that sounds good. Let's go to town. So we went to town, and, you know, and there was nowhere for me to turn now. I was there. I was by myself. I didn't know anybody down there. And, when crisis sets in and my brain is going 110 miles an hour, I know what to do. And I picked up a drink and I started drinking. And the crisis mode, it was really, really hard to quiet that. So I drank more heavily and more ferociously than I ever did. And it's trying to quiet that. And, you know, and one thing led to, you know, another down there. And, you know, along the way, you know, I met a woman who was in the program, and, you know, she gave me a bunch of pamphlets, and, you know, I tucked those pamphlets, and I don't even know what I did with them. I think I just carried them around. But I can remember one night after drinking, and I was up for like maybe a day or two or so. Who really knows, right? And I can remember like taking my pulse, and I'd been an athlete in college, and my pulse was flying way over 200, and I was like, this isn't good. I've never done this before. This is pretty high. And I fell to my knees, and I just said, you know, God, you know, I didn't even know that AA existed, really. You know, I need help. I can't go on like this. I just can't go on. And, you know, I didn't stop drinking, but, you know, the very next morning I woke up and all of a sudden it wasn't the same anymore. Like I was able to hear what people were saying to me, and I was able to feel it like I'd never really felt it before. And that's when the crisis mode really kicked in, because that's when I had the first inkling that I cannot drink. And that is a frightening, frightening place for an alcoholic like me, and probably maybe some of you, to be. And, I ended up homeless down there. One thing led to another. I ended up homeless and, eating my lunches at the Salvation Army. And, they really didn't take my dietary restrictions into consideration when they served up the plate of food, and had a little resentment about that. And, ended up at a shelter. I'm not a person, I don't want to be on the street. There's a shelter, I'll go there. So, I was at a shelter down there, and, ate my dinners at the Bethlehem shelter, and, from time to time, there's these grease barrels in the back of restaurants where they pour out the deep fryers, and some nights that was dinner, because there's remnants of food in there, and that's, I needed to nourish my body at some point. But, if you hung out with the kind of crowd I hung out with in St. Thomas, which is a very illustrious group of individuals, and, all of us knew that, in St. Thomas, they are just sick and tired of just people from the United States, from stateside, coming down there, and and just taking over their resources. And at the time, I actually had braids too, so they call me Yankee Rasta Man, and I was like, the braids, this is my source to my powers, the braids, and I can't cut the hair, and they had this thing called, it was a one-way ticket. They'll give you a one-way ticket off the island anytime you want. At least they used to have it. It's the what I call the today the get the vagabond off the island program. So at my darkest moments, I called up. I didn't want to stop drinking. I was like, I need to take advantage and I need to get the pro. Because I had counseling down there and I was getting food stamps and all kinds of great stuff. And I got that one-way ticket and, I went back to Minneapolis. And, like I said, St. Thomas is the place they love to export alcoholics. Just get out of here. And Minneapolis is like the place that imports alcoholics. Give them to us. I mean, Minnesota doesn't have the Minnesota model for nothing, or Minnesober. And I grew up there, and I had I don't know how I didn't notice it, but there was treatment centers in every corner. And literally there is, and I don't know how I grew up there and just was oblivious to that whole factor that, that existed. So I was supposed to go back to treatment in Minnesota, and I got off the plane, and maybe I'll just try beer this time. It's all the other stuff. It's the crowd. It's the quiet. It was the noise. There's too many people, and there's tourists and the cruise ships. But I just tried drinking, and ended up in a homeless shelter again. I don't know what happened. Just there I was. Because I could not function in society. I just couldn't do it anymore. Being homeless was it's just a lot of work. You have to shower. You can only shower in certain places, and I had to sleep with a bag of clothes. The only bag of clothes I had to sleep underneath me, because you're always worried about someone stealing your stuff. And it's just miserable. But I can remember just laying there and thinking, gosh, is this it? And I can remember one day taking my last drink at a place called the Bryant Lake Bowl, and my hands were just shaking all night long, just shaking, shaking, shaking. It's like, gosh, I can't even take a couple of drinks anymore, just a couple of sips anymore. What am I going to do? I'm just shaking, shaking, shaking. And then I can remember just laying there again with that pillow over my head, just going, I need help. God, I need help. And just think, I can't inhale because people are smoking crack and marijuana all around me. It's like, I don't want any of that stuff in me. But I had that frightening feeling, there's can't drink and can't not drink. And, they had this thing called the McKenna program around there. I was at the Drake homeless shelter in Minneapolis. And the McKenna program was a single men, and they had their own room, so they didn't have to worry about at least people, their roommates stealing from them. So I talked to those guys, and, I followed one of those guys over to a meeting that, one of those nights, and it was a men's stag meeting. I can remember walking in, and, oh, gosh, I don't need this. I need a girlfriend and alone. I don't need a men's stag meeting. That's not my problem. I just went, and I didn't know that was going to have a sobriety date. There was no plan, no intention. I just had the place. I was at a point where I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink. And I went to the meetings and I heard people not talk about alcohol and how they felt, but talk about how they just basic living and how they felt and how difficult it was, but just basic living, And today, that's alcoholism. But for me at the time, it was that pressure, And eventually, I got out of that treatment or that homeless shelter, and got a sponsor, and you know, like everyone else in Minneapolis, or at least it seemed like at the time, of course, I got a job in a coffee shop, because that's what you do if you get sober in Minnesota. You go to a treatment center or detox to coffee shop. So if any of you are in Minneapolis, be careful when you order your latte, because, you know, that person back there is probably one of us. But that was a fantastic job, because it was easy going, easy does it, and I really, really needed that. And I still was sitting there thinking about, you know, what's my problem, you know, but I got into a group called the Central Pacific Group, and it was a very solution, action-orientated group, and, you know, there's a guy named, you know, The Horn, you know, some of you in this room actually know this guy. He turned around his hand and reached out his hand to me and said, hi, and, you know, I'm going to be your sponsor, and, you know, in spite of, you know, coming over from the shelter and, you know, I thought I had it going on, right? You know, things are still going. I'm going to get it together. And obviously, you know, he was able to reach out. He just did the simple thing that we are taught here every day. Reach out your hand to another alcoholic. The same thing that Bill did with Bob. Reach out your hand to another alcoholic. And he did that for me and, you know, probably saved my life. Probably saved my life that day because, you know, I was dying inside and I couldn't tell anybody about it. Just couldn't because, you know, I could sit in a room like this and I could come in here and go, yeah, this is, and I heard everyone, you know, this program's working great for you, but you don't understand, you know, my case is different, and I had all my reasons. My case is different, so this fantastic thing, which is going to work for, you know, today, millions of people, somehow, some way, my case is different. But I kind of hung around, and when I hung around, you know, I started taking action steps, and, you know, I got my own apartment, and, you know, things slowly but surely started coming together, and you know, as I was working the steps, I can remember doing the fifth step one day with The Horn in the Loring Park in Minneapolis. And I was getting to that part where that stuff you don't want to share with anybody. And it started pouring rain. So I was like, oh, let's get up and go. And he's like, no, we're going to sit here. So the rain kept going and I kept talking, you know. And I was like, okay. And then he shared. And he shared the stuff that he did. And he talked about how he, not just what he did. I mean, him and I on the outside didn't have much in common. But that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, that doesn't matter. He talked about him, you know, him and the oil fields that he worked on in Wyoming, and I hadn't worked on any oil fields in Wyoming, but he talked about the feelings that he had inside as a person and how he felt and how he had to drink and why he drank, and I identified with that, and I said, me too. You know, and that's when I started to open up, and, you know, we went on, and, you know, I read the big book time and time and time again. I was like, I was still trying to figure out, like, what's my problem, you know, and I thought back, you know, eventually I figured out that, you know, my problem is not alcohol. Because when I was drinking, my solution was alcohol. That's what I used, good times, bad times, and everything in between. So just because I'm getting sober now, doesn't all of a sudden, like, I don't take my solution and move it into the problem column, you know? And I can no longer use my solution because I have to stay sober. So if I'm using my alcohol solution, I'm not sober, so I have to find a new solution. So it's kind of what I call, like, you have to know your A's. Now, we have A's all over the place, AA, alcoholism, abstinence, and you have to really know your A's in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, the first A is know that your problem is alcoholism, it's not alcohol, because, you know, it's that mind-controlling, you know, it's just that cunningness that just makes all of us drink again. I came and put my, you know, just that desire that someday I'm going to be able to drink like other people. And just how we chase that as far as possible. It's that, you know, that, and it's when we're sober and when we're not sober. It's alcoholism through and through. You know, and that's, eventually I figured out that was my problem. So my solution to that is, you know, another A, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. But even more particular, as it's pointed out, you know, in the big book, you know, the spiritual awakening, or as they started off with, you know, Bill's spiritual experience that he had in Towns Hospital. You know, the spiritual awakening, you know, which is over here, actually. You know, which is, you know, as a result of, you know, having worked through all the steps in order, you know, and that's how we come to, you know, the spiritual awakening. And then it's taking the actions. Again, see, it's really, see, it's more, you know, knowing your A's. But when we go through, you know, and we hit that spiritual awakening, that's, for me, that's when I understood, you know what, that I can live, you know, I can live without alcohol because I have this as my solution. So I finally, after a while, figured out that, you know, the solution to my problem was not abstinence. You know, to me, abstinence is just agony. It's just complete agony, like, oh, gosh, just give me a drink and get it over with. You know, That's where Alcoholics Anonymous kicks in. That's where, you know, because of the disease of alcoholism. You know, in this, you know, I just got, you know, got a good sponsor, got with a good group, and I was always doing the next right thing, always doing the next right thing. While I was at, you know, one of those coffee shops, I worked at a few coffee shops, by the way. Of course, we can't just work one place. Now, I was at one of those coffee shops, you know, I had a sponsor, like, well, what do you want to do? And, you know, so I, you know, went back and, you know, finished some of those credits, which, you know, that we kind of leave out there. That we'll get, I'll take care of that later, you know. And I went back, you know, because my plan was when I was in St. Thomas, by the way, that I was going to write a book, and I was going to publish it, and I was going to make millions. I was going to come back and pay off all those loans, and that was going to be the end of it, and I was going to be happy. And that didn't work out very well. And so, you know, and eventually, you know, I worked with that sponsor and, you know, finished those few, last few credits. And then eventually he's like, well, what do you want to do now? And it's like, well, I want to go to law school. And, you know, before I knew it, you know, I found myself several years later sitting there in a courtroom. And, you know, I kind of always knew I'd be in a courtroom one day, but I thought I'd be the guy going, please not guilty. Please reasonable doubt, reasonable doubt, reasonable doubt, you know. That wasn't the case, though. You know, I was the prosecutor. I was the one who was standing there giving the closing arguments, you know, in front of a, you know, a jury, saying, you know, why and so and so should be guilty for such and such crime. You know, and it just, I can remember sitting there, just it just kind of came to me one day. It's like, wow, this is so far from those days back in St. Thomas. What happened? How did I get here? It was just literally doing all the simple things one day at a time, all the simple stuff that, you know, that Bill and Bob worked on because of necessity. And that's kind of how they formed and packaged this whole thing together. And, you know, I went and I found my, you know, adoptive mother. I went through the adoption agency and, you know, ended up on some of these panels with other adoptees. And, you know, I sat next to me was one woman who had been at Oprah like a month before. I was like, I never got to be an Oprah. How come you got to be an Oprah, you know? You know, because, you know, she got to talk about her experience with adoption, you know. And I saw, you know, it was just one of the, you know, I met my mother one day, too, and if you're ever going to meet your birth mother, I recommend that you don't say, to, you know, wear white, and I'll meet you by the tree, because, you know, we were it was outside of a lake in Minneapolis, and I must have been 100 women. All I knew that she was white, and she was going to be wearing white, and must have been 100 women that came by, so I'm going like this the whole time, like, is it you, is it you, is it you, is it you, you know, and, you know, and she was lit, too, you know, but she came by, and we hugged and cried, and she had grass stains all over those white that white outfit. And it didn't matter. It was one of the most beautiful moments. And I was like, wow, how was I able to do this? It was because Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the strength to be that, you know what? All you have to do is suit up. That's an I never, by the way. You know, all you have to do is, you know, suit up, show up, and be yourself. And that's all I've ever wanted in life, is be able to suit up, maybe not always suit up, just show up and just be myself and be the person I've always wanted to be, the person I always knew that I could be, but for that pressure that was always on top of me. And that's what this fellowship has done for me, a day at a time, just taking a simple next right step. And I was able to, you know, meet a wonderful woman at law school, and we got married, and, you know, today we have, you know, thank you, today we have, you know, four daughters, and I can't say I've had them in the past week, though, but you know, we have, you know, four beautiful daughters, and, you know, I went through the trying experience of about a year and a half ago or so of switching my meetings from my Manhattan meetings to, like, meetings in Westchester, and I went through it and went out there. I was like, oh, they don't hold hands out here. It was, like, driving me crazy. I don't know why. It's a little simple thing like that, but you know what? That's just because, you know, you get sober, you get comfortable with change. And if that's the worst thing that I had to think about my day, my life is fantastic. And my life is absolutely fantastic. And I owe it to all of you. And say I would like to thank, you know, Bill and Bob for starting this simple program 77 years ago today. And I hope this simple program stays as simple today as it was then, because alcoholism is the same today as it was back then. And as far as I can tell, ever will be. So I want to thank them, God, my sponsor, Bill, who's sitting in the fourth row right there, and all of you. Thank you for my sobriety.